dear brothers and sisters.
And I don't know if that's something that you resonate with, in that sense, but it's even not getting, not that I'm not getting to, but the sense of not, I didn't do the exercise with someone just then. It's more, in a way, doing it with the whole group, for me, in that. And so I'm aware of this, again, this territory that I'm inviting you to engage, to touch into, to turn towards, may be impactful for you. And if there's anything coming in from this that you'd like to name or speak or share, you're very welcome to. If there's any way in which you notice something or something seemed useful or interesting or challenging in that exercise just now, exercise isn't quite the word, actually, I realize when I say it, it sounds there's something more to that than just an exercise. It's a truth telling in a very particular sort of way. And just be really gentle and kindly with yourselves. And whatever you experience, and exactly the same with whatever you may not experience, because there's no expectation or right experience here. You may not be feeling brotherhood and sisterhood. You might be feeling this is all a load of rubbish, and, you know, or don't know what it's got to do with me. I'll deal with that when I get there, you know. And again, no expectation from my part, but if anyone would wish to, like to, feels moved to say anything of what that was like for you just now, you're very welcome to do so.
Very strange, because it seemed something of great moment, of great importance, but giving it a very, very casual air, certainly with me, by verbalizing it. So, quite a contrast. Difficult to take it seriously, but then on another level, taking it very seriously.
Right.
Maybe it's something about death, I decided, being part of life. It's the extraordinary made ordinary by, I don't know, verbalizing it.
Yeah, it is a little, in a way, strange to do it in that way. And the language, of course, can become a refuge for staying distant from it. Because actually what we're talking about is something mysterious, something challenging at all levels, probably. And yet, at the same time, to some extent, unknown to us, because we haven't gone there. At least, certainly for myself, I have no conscious experience of that. Thank you.
I found it a really emotional moment, actually. And I felt a sense of being part of a group, big, large group, and it made me think of my other groups that I'm part of as well, and how losing someone that I'm very close to in one of those groups might feel. Touched a lot of things for me.
Right. So there's that, the strength of feeling, the sense of connection, and also the coming into contact. Well, you know, what will it be to lose someone?
Physical touch.
Interesting, yes, but physical touch. Sometimes there's something we need in that contact, or that just need is the wrong word. It's like there's something appropriate. We're moved to make contact, I think. Yeah. And it's clear that around, or certainly it can be the case that around death, there can sometimes be degrees of openness and intimacy amongst people who don't know each other so much, but whom that, and the friend I spoke about who I was with in his dying days, I didn't know him so well. I'd never met his wife or his daughter, or his ex-wife, who was the mother of his daughter. But that sort of, it just, when I made contact with them, sitting in the, I guess the funeral parlour is the old language of sitting with the body of my friend, their, you know, beloved being, it's like instantly there's a closeness. There's a closeness in that. Thank you.
I was surprised, actually. It surprised me. Because before starting it, I thought, I would not be troubled to take this seriously.
Yeah, that's tricky, yeah.
And, but what surprised me is that I'm the sort of person who cries easily, but something did touch me where I thought, are tears going to come up in a minute? And so for me, for something like me, it's surprise. And then I realized nobody's ever actually said this to me. You're going to die. Mm-hmm. They usually said the reverse, you know? Oh, you're looking great. I tell my age, I say, come on, you got another 30 years to go. Very rarely, this is the first time in my life somebody actually looked into my eyes and said, you're going to die. And it's some emotions which surprise me.
So there's something interesting about having the truth that we all know but don't speak.
Yeah.
Having it in a way uncovered and a bit more, there's something naked and vulnerable about it. Mm-hmm. To say it, to hear it, to affirm it. Because it kind of breaches that collective, well, let's, you know, it's there, but let's all just not look at it or quite name it. And even, you know, when someone says you're not going to die, or you're going to, I mean, you're probably not going to die right now of the thing that might hurt or scare you right now. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Probably. And probably they're right in this moment. Although at some moment they'll be wrong.
You know, that's absolutely true. When you're sick, they sort of just want to console you, saying, you're going to beat this. You know, however serious it is. You've got cancer? Don't worry, you'll beat this. Nobody says you've got cancer, you're going to die, man.
Yeah, or
shape up.
Or you haven't got cancer, you're going to die. Die of not having cancer. Because we will. It's one or the other, generally. You either die of having it or die of not having it. Thank you. Yeah. And you had your hand up?
Yeah, I think you mentioned vulnerability. That was my sense. Really strong feeling of connection in vulnerability.
Okay.
No wanting, no any defenses, just sort of letting go. You know, complete sense of openness and then that connection.
Right, and so very interesting. The vulnerability, the openness, and the connection come together. And that's the nature of actual connection and vulnerability. They actually are somewhat dependent on each other. We connect to the degree we're open to and vulnerable to another. Yeah, thank you.
We have somebody who suffers from death anxiety for many, many years. I used to say those things to myself, and that sent me into deep, dark holes for many years that led me into therapy. Death was very impacting. I would be saying to myself, I'm going to die. It's probably going to be soon.
Right.
And I was going to some very dark places and stuff. And, but actually now, I actually just felt an enormous sense of peacefulness inside me. Just felt deeply, deeply peaceful to me. Which is, you know, quite something after the journey that I've been on. Yeah. But it also felt very, very important to make connection with through the eyes of the other person. It felt very important to do that, not to turn away from it, but to know that this is absolutely true. And there is something that's almost kind of reassuring about it in a weird kind of way.
Yeah. So you've been on quite a journey with this territory.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, I'm just checking, can people hear okay? One or two not at the same. So the movement of the journey between I'm going to die as a basis of fear and real difficult experience, and recognising a movement through into the sense of actually some reassurance and the and peace coming out of that reflection. Now, I've played is the wrong word. I've explored and experimented with the languaging of the phrases that it seemed for me to be useful, and I noticed an incredible difference between I am going to die and I too am going to die. And I am going to die is kind of the expression of fear, and it's about me, which is scary. But I too, it's putting the fact of death in the context of universality, unavoidability. Whereas I am going to die is still in the sense of, and it shouldn't really happen.
Yes, there was never anything I too am going to die when I was younger, having what I would call death phobias.
Mm.
It was always, yeah, it was me personally.
Yeah. So it's important to see if the language, and it might be different language for us in such a reflection, what it actually touches, because there's no real value in just scaring ourselves, if that's what it does. Yeah, and that's also why doing it with someone who hopefully can hold some presence for us. It's like the reassurance of, oh yes, actually this is just how it is. And it's not something to be afraid of, because a lot of the messages we get from really early on is that this is not an okay place to look or to turn. The fear that's expressed in the way, as someone said to me walking back from the park earlier today, that it's all tidy and clean. There's not a single dead piece of living matter anywhere. All the leaves, all the branches are swept up and cleaned up and tidied up, and it's a very civilized park. So, you know, that's what they were expressing. And it's clear, oh yeah, we get rid of those things so quick. Despite the fact that those leaves are falling off and bits of plant are dying, someone's employed to make sure none of them are there for us to see. Probably a lot of people are employed. It's good, it makes employment, but in that sense, we do that a lot. And it's a real gift to offer something different. That's it. Thank you. Yeah.
I feel really relieved.
Interesting. You know, I'm reminded, and I think there was some mention of reassurance also, the previous person speaking there, and sometimes can be relief. I remember one of the first funerals I attended was the father of a friend of mine from university. And we were, as one did it, sort of age of relative youth and innocence, sort of, we were just sort of carefully talking about, so what happens now, you know, do you get reborn, is there heaven, is it all over, you know, we're just kind of tossing the idea around, having been at a funeral, and my friend, whose father had died, you know, someone was saying, oh yeah, getting reborn, that would be great, and my friend said, I'm not sure I want to go through all of this again. It was a very interesting response for me at that time. I remember, oh, actually I could see the point in that. That death can be both scary, and there can also be some sense of, oh, okay, so actually endings are sometimes not unwelcome when things are difficult. Now, I'm not suggesting that, oh yeah, so let's get it over with, sort of thing. That's quite a different orientation, but it's almost like there's a something about acknowledging the truth of endings that allows us to hold the small losses and defeats and things that occur in our lives. As we say, oh yeah, this is part of how it is. And again, just some sense of, oh, okay, there's a way in which we hold internally a certain kind of defendedness against letting it in. That there's a, oh, when we let it in, and just, oh, actually, I don't have to battle quite so hard to stop it happening. Even if it's actually not about to happen, and I'm still battling against it, because, oh, actually, no, it's natural. It's not a failure on my part. Good. Yes, back.
I can relate to what your friend said about wanting to be reborn again. I'm kind of hoping it's not true that he come back. Because I have to be quite comforting to think one day I'm going to die, I think, because I find life quite overwhelming a lot of time, and I struggle with things that seem to come really easily to other people. And sometimes just go to a cemetery. I love the cemeteries here in England because it's overgrown and old, and just think, yes, peace at last, I can't wait. But then I also realize that sometimes I have moments in my life where I didn't contemplate it. It was just like a moment of really being confronted with just on a more existential level with what I'm dead, and it was quite scary. So there's a contradiction. And I was quite surprised, because usually I always, since I've been a teenager, I can't wait till I'm dead. And then when these few moments I had where it really felt real, it was really scary.
Right. So it can be that we tend to pick up one side or the other more fully, And there can be the sense of, you know, endings brings release or relief, and it also brings loss. And we can kind of focus one way or the other, and most of us will have the tendency to orient one way or the other more habitually. And so when the tendency is more to the sense of relief or sort of coming to the end of the difficult, then it's like, oh, of course, we don't know what happens when we die. So we may not come to the end of the difficult. That's, in one sense, just a different version of a convenient fiction from the idea that it continues in some hopefully nicer way, which is the classic sort of social, religious, cultural sort of palliative. Is, oh, you know, well, that's all right, they're going somewhere nice, or we're going somewhere nice afterwards. But we do not know. We do not know. And I mean, in terms of, you know, the Buddha spoke a lot about the way that could influence and impact on how we live our lives. But the bottom line is, whichever position we take, it doesn't actually resolve the question of that both loss and liberation that may be there in death.
You know, the Buddha's time, people didn't live as long as we do. And so what came up for me is, I've kind of been a dancer most of my life, or much of it. I always had this identification with my body, but as I'm aging, it was like, what is worse for me is thinking, this mind, my mind too, is going to die. And in some ways, hoping it doesn't die before my body dies, but, you know, we don't know. Or my hearing, too, is going to die. I mean, whatever it is that you're starting to lose.
Yeah. So we have different elements of our experience that we identify with, that we hold as a sense of being. And we can see that actually having one of them operating, I mean, actually, if the mind goes first, that seems pretty scary. But actually, if the body goes first, that's pretty tough as well. By, you know, from what I've heard, to have the mind still functioning and the body not well, it's kind of like we somehow want them to go together, I think, because that's how we've known them. But whichever way that shows, it's kind of just, it's another sense of, oh, okay, there's some identity here with body, with mind. And those experiences are constructed and conditioned and break apart. So when we're talking about death, we're talking about not just the concept of some kind of ending, but the, in a way, unstoppable deconstruction of the frameworks and the material from which we have a sense of who we are.
Yeah.
Identity.
Yeah.
And often that's where a lot of the fear is. So again, good to see that. Thank you.
I'm experiencing this fear of public speaking that you've mentioned as being worse than death. Because of having to wait and getting nervous. When you talked about your conversation with your friends, I had an image of climbing up a mountain and thinking that I probably would only want to die if I was really, really suffering, really in pain, and, you know, beyond a certain level. But really, there's a sense that I have somewhere to go, somewhere to get to, and that I don't want to die before I've got there. And I know it's a complete illusion. And when I did the exercise over the long night, I did feel some peace and relief and total connectedness to the present moment. I think, you know, if I could feel that often enough, I could probably let go of that idea of somewhere to go and self-improvement, you know, perpetual self-improvement.
Yeah. Well, I think when you name it as perpetual, then one sees the problem with trying to get there.
Yeah.
You know.
Exactly.
You know, just that old thing about, you know, the bear climbed over the mountain to see what he could see.
That's right. When you get to the
top, another mountain.
There's still another mountain. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Good. Good. So, was there someone else? Yes.
I was just going to say, about a week ago, like I had an experience where it did come to me, it did dawn on me that I was going to die. I sort of knew that it was going to happen. And the feeling that it could happen at any time. And it was like a source of, it was just kind of made everything seem a bit pointless, because it's just like, what's the point of planning and kind of stuff like that. So, I mean, I wasn't like anxious about it, but yeah, I had that kind of realization. And then I was talking to someone about it. So I guess I was scared about it. Sorry, I don't know if this is coming out right. But anyway, and then I watched some videos of near-death experiences on YouTube, and then I wasn't really. I mean, I'm sure I am still scared about it, but I wasn't scared about it after watching those, and it kind of looked pretty good. But I think at the moment I feel like I don't feel that. I guess I don't feel like I'm going to die, because it feels like actually no, there's going to be something else. But I don't feel the sort of preciousness or the vulnerability at the moment, or the sort of connection. I just feel like, oh, okay, it's good.
So again, we can be in different places, and it may be that from a place of more fear, anxiety about death, to actually go to a place where there seems to be more confidence, or no longer quite sure exactly what death is. Because when we're attached to death as a fearful thing, again, that's just a construct coming out of the mind. When we attach, or when we relate to death as a lovely thing, like floating around sort of in some blue-green light or whatever, which might be one near-death experience or something like that, it's got a more positive spin to it, so to speak. Neither of those is actually going to be able to hold the truth of it, but it may be a good counterbalance if our tendency is to go in the other way. Because actually, fear of death is a tendency, it's that when we're getting into the fear, it's more projecting forward into the future. It's what death does, I think, there is it takes away somewhat the sense of the pull into the future. In terms of pointlessness, it is a bit pointless to try and do things only for the future, because we may never get there. But where there is meaning and where there is significance is actually something more about how one lives in the present moment, how one relates and holds that. And one can do so actually from a sense of confidence, probably more usefully than a sense of fear. But the question is always with those to see, is one setting it up as a position and attaching to it? It's more actually, you know, we also don't know what death will be. We can't know what death will be. And so far as we're relating to concepts of it, we need to understand we're relating to concepts. Whether they're fearful ones or happy-making ones, they're concepts. But with that's all part of the territory. So what's important there is just to see where you are and to trust that, to honour that.
Yeah, because I did, when we were doing the meditation before we did the exercise as well, like I did have this feeling of like wanting to just like fall into it or something and like let go, but there was, yeah.
Okay. Good, thank you. Okay, perhaps the last one, yeah.
I just wanted to know whether or not you've tried that exercise with somebody who actually is in the process of dying.
I don't know if I'd do it quite like that, but yes, with my friend, in a sense, part of what was there was to actually say, you're dying, and this is, you know, part of what for me felt right thing to say is, yes, this is taking your life, and it's going to take it sometime soon, that we weren't pretending around that. So I'm not sure I would suggest it as a sort of a necessarily or automatically appropriate thing, but this friend was a Dharma practitioner and someone who'd reflected in this way, and you know, interestingly, I'm not in exactly that many words, but I did feel that part of what was right to say is, yes, you're dying, you're gonna die, that's what's happening here. And interestingly, when he was in the the hospice, a Tibetan lama who just happened to be passing by and was told, well, he's a Dharma practitioner. He came in and said to him, it's okay, you can go. There'll be another body for you. Another body's waiting for you. So it's kind of like, well, that's nice. I mean, again, I'm not saying that's how it is. But it was like, it was very much that, that's the response within that tradition, within that particular view. So it's like, yes, you're going to die, but don't worry. Well, your body is going to die and you get another one. And, in some ways that makes a lot of sense for me. But I don't think, in fact, I'm reminded of the words again of Khalil Gibran and the Prophet, when he says, and I think the imagery of this end of the book is as if the speaker, the teacher, the seer, who's the prophet, is leaving on a journey on a boat. But the way he describes it, I think he's talking about his death. And he says, and in fact there's clear evidence there, but he says, it is not a suit of clothes I cast off today, but a skin that I tear. And it's like, he has some sense, and he says, and before long another woman shall bear me. So he's obviously thinking in terms of rebirth, but, and again, I'm not trying to answer or speak even to those questions, because I think they can be a little bit of a distraction from the kind of the contemplation in a certain way. But that sense of, it's not a set of clothing I discard here, it's a skin that I tear. I mean, and we're not just talking about skin, we're talking about everything underneath it is going to have to be off. So there's the potential for it to be challenging anyway, it would seem. Because it's actually not just the physical, but the whole sense of who and what we are in relationship to everything else is going to go. Must go. Irrespective of what comes after that. So that's one of the reasons that one, practices to be able to meet and open in the face of what may or may not, but may be challenging in that way. But good, thank you. Yeah. And I'm just aware when I hear and respond to you, not all of my responses to what was said are just kind of where I've gone from it. So don't take it as a specific response to everything if it's not always relevant. So, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, it's interesting, I think, to just hear and to share the different responses, the different experiences, to see. This may not be something that you go back and, tell your partners or your kids or your workmates, hey, I've got this really cool thing, let's sit down. there's some kind of making of a framework for it. And yet there are times when actually what's needed is to be able to say to someone who maybe is dying, like, yeah, this is what's happening. Or to someone where, maybe a child where someone has died, to be able to say, yes, this is what's happened. But not entirely sugarcoating it. But we have to listen and see what's true for ourselves and a situation to know what's appropriate. The interesting thing is, it's rare to know that it's imminent. Because yes, I'm going to die is different than yes, I'm going to die very soon. And in a certain way, it's a challenge and a privilege to know that, if that's the case. It's not a privilege we all have.
But we can pretend.
We can
pretend, effectively.
That we're dying very soon.
Yes, we can live as if we are.
As a practice, one can.
Yes.
Yeah.
Some of us do.
Yeah. Can be. Though again, the truth of it is that we might die soon. Yeah, and we might not. So, just some of the things that, for me, have been important coming out of this reflection and contemplation, I'd just like to share, in terms of, because really, we're talking about contemplating death, but really we're talking about how do we live in a situation where this is so. The only certainty is death. The time of death is uncertain. How should I live? This is kind of the way it's framed in one of the Zen traditions, as a reflection, as a question, and to see this process of being alive as in some ways a practice for dying
and dying well. Apparently Plato, when he was asked near his the end of his life, when he was asked, you know, what's important? What's important? He responded, practice dying. Practice dying. What does that mean for us? You know, to actually let ourselves be impacted by what that might mean, by how that might be. I mean, one of the things that I find is a very simple expression of that that's really useful is in terms of how many commitments and responsibilities we have that make it hard for us to take time for what's important, you know? And sometimes I say to people when they're not sure if they've got time for meditation or they're not sure if they've got time to go on a retreat, you know, give the world some practice at getting on without you. Give it the chance to check out and know that it will manage. Because it's going to have to one day. This world is going to have to get on without you. And, you know, a friend and fellow teacher, Fred Van Elman, when I was in it, I've got all these things, and he said to me once, he said, you know, so what if you get run over by a bus tomorrow? And of course, absolutely not wishing for that to happen, but if it happens, all those things, someone else is going to have to deal with them. Or they're not going to get done today. So it's like, okay, maybe it's okay to put things down unfinished sometimes, unconcluded, incomplete, imperfect. Because at some point, that's what's going to happen. And there's something about the okayness of doing that now. Just, okay. And I can make time then for what is most important. To have some time to meditate, to have some time to go on retreat, to attend a workshop, to reflect on that which is important for me. Did you want to ask something just
then?
Yeah.
Yeah? This is something I struggle with a lot.
Sorry?
Something I struggle with a lot, yeah. Like what we're talking about now.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing what I want to do and feeling all these duties on to get obligations to not do. Being a pragmatist, I tend to not necessarily consciously make the choice to do the other thing and find myself feeling some suffering as a consequence of making suffering. I might die tomorrow, but there again, I might not. And it's that thing, you know, so I could say, no family or no work, I'm not going to do it because I want to do what I need to do now. I love your family, I appreciate your work, but right now what I want to do is this. And then I might not die tomorrow. And then there's a whole series of consequences of having prioritised myself and not my obligations in quotes.
Yeah, and life inevitably involves imperfect choices with potential downsides. I think it's very much a case of balance. You know, at one sense we could say if it's the most important thing for you, then whether or not you die the next day, the fact that you chose to do it and followed what was most important is a worthy choice. It's not to say it wouldn't be without its challenges. And by the nature of it, choice usually means there's a downside in both options. Otherwise we don't make a choice, we just do it. Any option with no downsides, we just take it, we don't call it a choice. Choice always involves loss and risk of loss. So we can't extract ourselves from that dilemma. It's not possible. But what we can do is let whichever loss we're taking or choosing be conscious, be known, and be felt. So in that sense, we're doing the dying of that loss here and now. We're not storing it up for later. When, oh my gosh, then I for the first time let myself see and think and feel about all the things that may have been those losses. And that's part of where it's about being immediate with what's there. Okay, I choose this and it's a loss to me and I might feel sorry to not take care of what I wanted to for myself. And equally if it's not taking care of my family in that moment, that's a loss. So either way, let that be found. Because those losses are the, in a way, the small deaths of life. And can be much more easily digested as they arise, rather than in their accumulation. So, interestingly, yeah, just to continue with that theme a little, in terms of things that are that are important, you know, the practice of ethics, of precepts, of so far as we can not causing harm. This is something the Buddha spoke to a lot about, you know, that things where we've caused harm to others or ourselves, these are the things that impact us deeply. And so having an intention to not do it is to actually live a life with less regret or potentially with no regret. And yet, of course, the truth is there's no perfect path through where no one gets hurt ever or anything gets impacted harmfully ever. That's impossible. So where we know about it, letting ourselves feel what regret we might have for the losses inherent in our choices. Losses to others, losses to ourselves. In a very simple way, I know when I get in my car, I'm going to kill small creatures. I see them on the radiator and the windscreen. Occasionally, very, very rarely, but there's a risk that I could kill a large creature. That happens with cars, if you get in them and use them, and I do. So there's a kind of a just letting myself feel the sorrow and the grief of the doing of it or the taking the risk of it. And just let that be part of my relationship to that very ordinary, in one sense, activity of driving a vehicle or something like that. And so also there's a forgiveness of understanding that we can't be perfect. We can't live in the world without having an impact on others. The only way we can do that is by something that will have an impact on ourselves. Right? If we don't move, we don't eat, we don't breathe, we won't hurt anyone else, but actually we will, and in fact, that isn't the answer. But being conscious, allowing oneself to be to feel it, that is actually, I think, where we then find the support for making authentic choices that we don't regret, understanding imperfection and inevitable loss in choices. I'm not by any means a master of that. I don't want to give that impression. I can say it in as many words. It is hard. And that's part of, you know, really the Buddha's first noble truth. In this world, things aren't perfect. There is unsatisfactoriness, dukkha, suffering, different language we can use. And that's how it is. It's not our fault. But we feel it. There's something about completion, about, particularly with people that we're close to, taking the chance to tell them what we'd want them to know if they or I was to die. You know? Those things that, not just did we tell someone, you're going to die, I'm going to die, but did we say, I love you? Or, I'm sorry. Well, goodbye. You know, to actually say, when I walked out of the room with my friend, there was this part of me that said, I could say see you later because I might. But actually, I knew I needed to say goodbye because there was a good chance I wouldn't see him again alive, and I didn't. And it wasn't like, you know, this is our last goodbye, but it's more like just be honest with that, be clear with that. This is a goodbye. And kind of letting ourselves feel that. When my wife Catherine and I got married, we opened the ceremony with Catherine singing a song that she kind of crafted from an Aztec prayer. And the refrain, which was a little surprising, I think, for some of the people at the wedding, it wasn't the traditional thing one says at the beginning of a wedding. This was 20 years ago in September, actually, so not such a short time. But the phrase was, only for a short time, life has loaned us to each other. And it goes, because we take form in life's act of drawing us. And we live in life's act of painting us. And we breathe in life's singing us. But only for a short while. Yes, only for a short while, life has loaned us to each other. Because even a drawing cut into crystalline obsidian fades. And even the green feathers, crown feathers of the quetzal bird, lose their colour. And even the sounds of the waterfall die out in dry season. So we too. Because only for a short time life has loaned us to each other. So we too. And as I said, I think it was a little bit of a surprise for some of the people there that we would choose to dwell on that particular facet of life at that point, where one tends to talk about sort of commitment and continuity and the anticipation of sort of long happy lives together. And yet for me then and now, it's that sense of remembering this, that we remember how precious, how fortunate we are to have contact with anyone in any form or way, in fact, and that isn't guaranteed. And for a long time, we don't so much now, but for a long time when we would go off, as one or the other of us would quite regularly, teaching and other things, we would just take a moment to pause and say, you know, I hope I see you again.
I hope
I see you again. Because it was true, I did. But normally we just assume we will. And there is no guarantee. I know, particularly flying in planes, but equally, it's more dangerous getting in cars, reality. But just going out into life, it's like that. You know, every day people don't see again someone who they thought they would see again. And just naming it allows a certain truth to be acknowledged, both the tenderness and the care and the vulnerability, as a way of meeting and parting. Can be very powerful, very beautiful. And that sense of, if it should come to that, what was most important has been communicated here. And every year I teach in Sweden, where my grandmother lives, and she's 97 now. And every year I go there once a year, and I see her and think, is this the last time? And she's still really with it and functioning fine and quite mobile. She's from India and she goes back there most years for a month or two. These days accompanied by my mother or my aunt, generally, not on her own, but you know, it's like, wow, she's still really alive. And she could be absolutely not alive very easily, very soon. She had double pneumonia the last time and could have gone, but didn't.
You know that Catherine started a Dharma talk with a call for order number?
Sorry? Yes.
Catherine said, you know, I've heard her sing it.
Yes.
Every time I say goodbye,
I die a little. Yeah. Yes, I won't attempt to sing anything. Some of you know why. Yeah. Yeah, understanding that, I mean, that's a little bit more to do with sort of the construction of self around in contact, but there's also a truth of parting. There's some death in it. There's a portal into that there. So when we reflect in this way, there's also the encouragement to, actually, maybe, should we have a little bit more cool air coming in? It seems to move between being cold and being warm, so just seeing one or two of you looking warm, I'm pretty warm at this end. If anyone gets cold, let me know and we'll go for the other version. But interestingly, just like life, it's kind of hard to get it right. It's either one or the other. But we can kind of pendulum a little bit back and forth. There's this invitation to live for what's true for where we are. And so much of spiritual teaching, of Dharma teachers, of living for the moment, for where we are. Coming back into this, that kind of punctures also our self-importance, the sense of it's all orienting around me that we so easily get into, and it's not. And, you know, it will get on when we're gone. It will continue, this world, you know, this life, one way or another. And yet, as I said also, that reflecting in this way, seeing the preciousness of it, how do we want to live in this world? If we see its vulnerability, its preciousness, our life and the life of everyone around us. There's a wonderful body of teaching generated by Stephen Levine in the realm of reflecting on and working with death. And he's written a book and has a program associated with it that some of you may know called A Year to Live, in which one is invited to live as if one would be dying at the end of the year, and taking a 12-month program where making choices, making decisions, making or engaging in relationships as if that were true. And I think it's a very powerful, it's not a course I've actually done, though I've, you know, known people who've used it and found it really beneficial, really interesting, very challenging, and actually very uplifting as well. But in his book, A Year to Live, he says at one point, in reflection on this process, he says, and I find it beautiful and remarkable, the words he chooses. He says that in this, it becomes clear that, quote, love was the only rational act of a lifetime. And for me, something in that, we think of love as somehow not being rational. There's all these rational things we're supposed to do that mostly aren't about love. They're about getting ahead and being productive and, you know, all those things. And yet love was the only rational act of a lifetime. What makes sense? What makes sense? This is the question, isn't it? In a world where we and each other are not here forever. It is that caring for, that sensitivity to, that supporting of, that kindness towards. These expressions of our life, of our heart, in relationship to each other and ourselves. That's what makes sense in the end. And we know that, of course, we know that. And yet we don't always find our way to that, partially because I think of the degree, or I think it partly the degree to which we're not really letting ourselves be in contact with the truth of death, the reality of death. We're not in contact with that imperative also, which says find ways to express the love that you have, that you are, and that this world so needs from you and offers you likewise. So, brothers and sisters, I'd like to invite you to take 20 minutes now to go for a little walk, if you need to go to the loo or anything, to wander around. Don't do formal walking meditation, but wander around, have your eyes up, have your eyes open. And just let yourself contemplate who you see. There may be people from this group, there may be people downstairs. Just taking a moment to let yourself know that this person too is going to die. Just as we ourselves. It's like you too are going to die. Oh yeah, you too are going to die. And just gently again holding that contemplation or allowing that contemplation to come in. Seeing what feels right or okay for you. Not forcing yourself to somehow have to have a feeling, but just see what it's like. Oh, okay. If I see these people, you know, and all the different reactions or responses we may have to them or may not have to them normally, just letting that be there if it's there, but just, oh, you too, you're going to die. Or that body will not escape death. And whether death is a full stop or a doorway, we don't need to resolve it there for that conversation. It's just, okay. And so then we'll come together and come back at about 4 or just after. Just to say, I guess you all know, I just mentioned, we'll be intending to be finished for 5 o'clock. So that's